All right, I think I only got up to five, didn't I? Okay, so, and I didn't say anything about five yet. We're looking at the interior of the airway here. On the top, this is a view of the larynx, which of course is just superior to the trachea. And so we see the vocal apparatus here. The larynx includes what are called vocal folds and vestibular folds. Now, the vocal folds are what most people call the vocal cords. Those are interchangeable terms. And so they are like little guitar strings, basically. There's one on either side. But attached to each one, on one side only, is a vestibular fold. And the vestibular fold is just a membrane. It's a sheet of tissue going from the vocal cord or the vocal cord, going from there laterally, filling up that space. All right? The vocal cords themselves, the vocal folds, can be repositioned. Notice that they're in a kind of a lambda configuration right here, upside down V. But that can be turned, they can come together on this posterior view. Notice the front is toward the top here, back is on the bottom. The rear part of them can approach each other, the two vocal folds, and close off that space, in other words. And since they're connected to the vestibular folds, that will drag the vestibular folds toward the middle as well. And so the vestibular folds are like an accordion door, right? That has a frame that you pull, and then that, otherwise it's in a pocket or something that it collapses, but then when you pull it, it will drag the accordion part along for the ride. What I'm trying to say here is that when the vocal cords or the vocal folds are pulled medially, the vestibular folds follow and therefore seal off pretty well the airway. Last time I said that the epiglottis helps in preventing food and drink from entering the airway during deglutition. But I said that that's not a good enough seal. You have to have a better seal than just that. Well, that better seal is made by the vestibular folds being pulled medially by the vocal folds. So that happens not during speech, because the vocal cords come together, but during deglutition. During normal breathing, you're not using the vocal folds for vocalization, so they are moved laterally. What movement would that be? What kind of movement? Abduction. Which one are you saying? You said both.
Abduction.
No.
Abduction.
Right. Just remember kidnapping, which is abduction. You're taking away the kid. Abduction is movement away from the midline. Adduction is bringing it back. So during normal breathing, the vocal cords or the vocal folds are abducted just to maximize the amount of airflow through the larynx into the trachea, and in reverse as well during exhalation. During swallowing or deglutition, they are fully adducted to seal off the airway to prevent any food or drink from getting in there. And then during speech, it depends on what noise you're trying to make. So the vocal folds can be adducted or abducted and tightened along their length as well. The tension can be tuned, just like the tuning of a guitar string or a violin string, by putting more tension on it. and therefore the pitch can be changed, of course. What vibrates the vocal cords, though, or vocal folds, is air rushing past them. That will vibrate them, and like any cord or string or anything like that, or band, elastic band, they will vibrate at a certain resonant frequency, which depends on how tightly they are being pulled. That's how you adjust the pitch. But that is just the very beginning of what ends up being whatever sound you're making. That doesn't make the words that you're speaking. That just produces the original sound with a certain... It provides a tone of a certain frequency and also a certain loudness, because you can breathe through them with either forcefully or not so forcefully. So that gives you tone and loudness. But what actually makes it sound like words is what happens in the mouth after it's out of the larynx. The things that you do with your tongue, your teeth, your cheeks, and your nasal sinuses, paranasal sinuses, is what gives the final sound to it. So the tongue really is the most important thing in determining what the actual words sound like, if it's speech you're doing. If you're just trying to sing notes, then it is largely the larynx doing the job. But it's definitely what the noise that's produced at the larynx is highly modified by stuff that's happening in the head. On the bottom picture, we're farther down. So the scope with the camera here is actually inferior to the voice box or larynx. It's looking at the very bottom or inferior part of the trachea. And you already know that the trachea bifurcates, right, into two bronchi. Well, that's why you see two openings here. And that bifurcation point is called the carina or carina. Either one is fine. All right, that's all we're looking at there. In 6, we can see this action happening in cartoon form that I just described during the photographs. So notice that the vocal cords are connected to the arytenoid cartilages that we talked about, one on each side. And the corniculate cartilages are there as well, but remember they're connected to each other by ligaments. It's a swiveling of the arytenoid cartilages that actually abducts or adducts the vocal cords. And so that happens because muscles are pulling on those cartilages. All right, so that's what you're doing when you are... The coracoarytenoid muscles are actually either contracting or relaxing, allowing this thing to swivel in one direction or the other. That's what you're doing when you're changing the pitch of your voice, but it's also what you're doing without even thinking about it when you're swallowing, because you're bringing these vocal cords together so that the vestibular folds seal off the airway. Okay. Now to 7. I've described this a couple times already in this course, but now you get to see a picture of it happening. This is the so-called mucociliary escalator, which I didn't use that phrase before, but I've told you what happens. The lining of the trachea is mucus, which means it produces mucus, the stuff. It's not only a mucus membrane, though. It's a ciliated mucus membrane. So the various particles that you don't want to actually end up in the lung get stuck to the sticky mucus, the ciliary beating back and forth, sweep that mixture of mucus and debris upward until it reaches the place where airway and foodway meet, which is at the pharynx, right? And this continual sweeping means that you just more or less continuously swallow this combination of mucus and debris, sending it to the stomach where it basically just gets destroyed rather than hurting you. We can also see a good view on the bottom right in this cross-sectional view of the airway through the trachea, which, remember, has C-shaped, not O-shaped cartilages, because O-shaped would not allow for any adjustment to the diameter. The C-shape, the opening in the C, allows for that adjustment. And so notice that there are muscles, trachealis muscles, joining the two ends of the C, and therefore when the trachealis muscle contracts, it's going to make that C come to close up a little bit more, which is how you can adjust the diameter of the trachea. And you might think, well, why do you want to do that? Because why not just have an always open airway? You do under normal circumstances. But if you really want to force air as much as possible through the larynx to really make a loud sound, for instance, you can close it down, and that's going to force all the air to be moving faster through this smaller airway. That's one reason. But then there's also the other reason: when you have a cough reflex, because something, there might be some debris that's trying to get into your trachea that shouldn't, you will automatically close up these C's to make it smaller, at the same time recruiting muscles that will force air out, muscles that we'll talk about that are breathing muscles, so that there's really a rapid flow of air through this, which will hopefully take the solids with it. And in the left, you can see a good view of just the tracheal tree, or at least the beginning of what's called the bronchial tree, the beginning of the bronchial tree. Trachea itself ends right here, as I said, at the carina or carina. And remember that there's different names to the bronchi. What's another name for the main bronchi? Primary bronchi, yes. So there's two of those because there are two lungs. What's the next level of bronchi? Secondary, which are also called what? You're looking right at it, by the way. Lobar. Lobar bronchi are secondary bronchi. And why are they called that? Right. Each one serves or delivers air to its own lobe. But what are lobes? Those are subdivisions of the lung, right? How many lobes in the left side, on the left lung? Two, and there's three on the right. That's why you have two left lobar bronchi that come from that left main or primary bronchus, and you have three right lobar bronchi that split from the right primary bronchus or main bronchus. Each one of those lobar bronchi then divide into segmental bronchi, because each lobe in the lungs is further subdivided into functional units called segments. So each segmental bronchus delivers air to its own segment within a lobe. And therefore, that entire segment gets air and is emptied of air at the same time. Well, I mean, it's all happening simultaneously, but they are functional subdivisions because each one gets its own bronchus, basically. Let's go on to 8. Look at the overall exterior view of the lungs with the pleura having been removed. Pleurae, there are two pleurae, by the way. Each lung has its own pleural membranes, or its own pleura. But you can see the arrangement of the lobar bronchi with respect to the lobes right here, and each lobe, as I said, has its own segments. Now, there are a total of 10 segments in the right lung, only 8 segments in the left, which makes sense because the left lung only has two lobes because of the position of the heart in most people. So this is really not any new information. What we haven't talked about, though, is that the divisions between the lobes you can see from the exterior view of the lung. It's not a conceptual division. It's a true anatomical division. There are cracks between the lobes. And these cracks are called fissures. It's another word for crack. Well, hopefully it makes sense to you that if the right lung has three lobes, there are two cracks. Whereas the left lung having only two lobes has only one fissure or one crack. So that single fissure that's in the left lung, if you look at a cadaver, you can see it just as you see here. It's cut at an oblique angle. So it's called the oblique fissure. And that's the only fissure in that lung. On the right lung, it has its own oblique fissure, but it also has a fissure that is more transverse and therefore horizontally placed. So it's called the horizontal fissure. Well, the oblique fissure in the left lung separates the only two lobes it has, which are the superior and the inferior lobes. The right lung has three lobes, so it's not enough to just say superior and inferior. There's also a middle lobe. The horizontal fissure separates the superior lobe from the middle lobe. The oblique fissure of the right lung, because there are two obliques, remember, separates the middle lobe from the inferior lobe, as you see here. And by the way, the place where the tubing connects, not only the bronchi and bronchioles, but also major vessels in each lung, gets the same name for the same reason as the place of connection that the spleen had, right? Which was the hilum. And also a lymph node, for that matter, had a hilum, where all the tubing comes together. So this region that you see on the bottom, which is the mediastinal surface, you're looking at it from where the heart would be, basically. That's the hilum of that lung. Each lung has a hilum. Now to 9. The photograph here, of course, is not from a living person. This transverse section through the lungs was made in a cadaver. And this black region right here, which is called the pleural cavity, is something that you wouldn't find in a living person. Well, I shouldn't say that the pleural cavity doesn't exist, but it wouldn't be opened up like this. The pleural cavity refers to the potential space, and I say potential space because it really is closed usually, but it's the space between the two layers of the pleura. The pleura, remember, is a serous membrane, and like all serous membranes, there are two layers of membrane. So what are the general names for those two layers in any serous membrane? Visceral is one of them. And parietal. What does parietal mean? Of a wall, right. So the parietal layer in any serous membrane is the more superficial, which means it's the layer that's not in direct contact with whatever is being surrounded by that serous membrane, in this case the lung. Visceral is the other layer. The visceral layer in any serous membrane is the part that is in direct contact with the thing being surrounded by the serous membrane. So the visceral pleura, as you see here, is directly on the surface of each lung. But there are two separate pleurae. This one is directly on the surface of the right lung. There's a visceral pleura over there as well. The parietal pleura, though, normally in a human, a living human, the visceral and parietal pleura are almost touching each other at all times. Now, as as in any serous membrane, there's fluid between the two, but it's a thin sheet. That serous fluid is the general word for that stuff, but it gets a name based on whatever serous membrane we're talking about. So in the case of the pleura, it's called pleural fluid. Just a very thin sheet of liquid, though, between these two membranes, the visceral and the parietal pleura. And that's important because the pleura not only functions for reduction of friction, like we've talked about, so that what doesn't happen? Right, so they don't rub the hell out of each other. That's a major function of a serous membrane, but the pleura also functions importantly for breathing, as we'll see, for inspiration. It's only able to do this if there's nothing but liquid between the two membranes. And that's because liquid can't easily be compressed or expanded, unlike a gas, right? A gas is easily compressed and easily expanded. Well, if you pull on a liquid, whatever is on the other side of that liquid is going to be pulled along for the ride, because unlike a gas, if you have two solids separated by gas and you pull on one solid, the gas is just going to fill up that space. It's not going to pull the other solid behind it with it. But if two solids have liquid in between them and you pull on the first one, because of the incompressibility and inexpandability of the liquid will then convey that pulling to the other solid and drag it along for the ride. This is why your lungs would not inflate if you have air in that pleural cavity instead of just liquid. What do we call that abnormal condition when air gets in that space? Colloquially, it's called a collapsed lung, but there's a pathological name for it as well. It's pneumothorax. Okay? Pneumothorax can kill you because, as we'll see later, when you're trying to inhale, what you're really doing is pulling on the parietal pleura, which then normally pulls on the liquid, the pleural fluid, which pulls on the visceral pleura, which is connected to the lung, so that pulls on the lung surface and expands it. Well, that won't happen if you have air in there. Yes, the parietal pleura will get pulled away, but the air in the pleural space will just expand, and therefore the visceral pleura will not be pulled at all, and the lung will stay small. It won't be expanded. So you wouldn't see this in a normal human. It would be closed off like this with just a tiny amount of pleural fluid in between the two. Okay, now let's go to 10 and look at very close-up view of the air sacs that make up the lung. Now, some animals that do have kind of sac-like lungs, they're just balloon-like, one big cavity. We can't have such a lung because we are endothermic organisms, which means we create our body heat via metabolism. So we have a much higher metabolic rate and therefore need a lot more oxygen exchange than something like a snake, for instance, would. So we need to have many, many, many tiny sacs rather than just one big sac, because when you divide it into tiny, tiny sacs, what are you doing? What is increasing when you do that? Surface area. The surface area to volume ratio of these bags. And therefore, what you're really causing is the air that's in the space to be very much closer to the wall of the sac than it would be if you had air in the middle of a big bag. So it allows for a lot more exchange when there's a lot more surface. And so each lung, functionally speaking, is divided into, well, structurally, I should say, is divided into tiny bags called alveoli, which are the functional units of the lung. Alveoli is the plural, by the way, of alveolus, which really just means little bag. All right, now, I was talking about the bronchial tree a little bit ago. It is it's called a tree because it's highly branched, just like a real tree, a plant is. Right? But we've talked about a little bit of that branching, but not all of it. So you have the trachea originally, that's like the trunk of the tree, just one of them. And then two primary bronchi, they split into lobar bronchi, which split into segmental bronchi, which split into bronchioles. And there can be several levels of splitting, just still calling them bronchioles. So you're getting, not only are you getting smaller and smaller tubes, but you're getting a lot more of them. And eventually, you'll, at the not at the very end, despite the name, but after several more levels of branching, you'll have what are called terminal bronchioles. Bronchial is a word that simply means small bronchus. So all these tubes are bronchi, but a bronchiole is a smaller version. Everything from trachea through terminal bronchioles are part of what we call the conducting part of the airway, or the conducting system. And that's because no appreciable exchange of CO2 and O2 with the blood takes place. It's called the conducting system because all that's happening is you're conducting the air from the mouth or nose to the lung. You're just getting it from A to B. You're not allowing it to, I mean, you're not, no appreciable exchange is taking place with the blood, which is what you really want to happen eventually, of course. So there's even more branching that takes place after the terminal bronchi, despite the fact the bronchioles, even though terminal means the ends. It really just is called that because it's the end of the conducting system. After the conducting system comes the respiratory system, or the respiratory part of the airway, and that gets its name for not actual respiration, like I said, but for exchange of O2 with CO2 at the blood. And so the first part of that respiratory part are what are called respiratory bronchioles, and you can see some of those in this figure right here. Respiratory bronchioles have alveoli here and there on pouching out of them. But then respiratory bronchioles, well, let me actually go to the next slide, 11, to make more sense of this. You can see a terminal bronchiole right here. And notice terminal bronchioles do not have any alveoli on them. That's why there's no exchange taking place. That's why it's still part of the conducting only part. But then they branch into respiratory bronchioles, which, even though they are going to branch again, along their length here and there, they'll have some alveoli. So there is some exchange taking place in the respiratory bronchioles. Then the respiratory bronchioles, and I guess they don't actually even show the detail here, those branch into what are called alveolar ducts. And alveolar ducts also have alveoli along their length, but they end in what are called alveolar sacs, which you see right here. An alveolar sac and an alveolus, those are not interchangeable words, even though alveolus means little sac. An alveolar sac is a bag-like collection of sacs itself. So this whole big thing is an alveolar sac, and it's made up of several different alveoli. And you find that at the end of an alveolar duct. You find the sac at the end of the duct. Okay? So these terminal bronchioles, which are the ends of the conducting part of the pathway, there are tens of thousands of those, 60 to 70,000 of those in the lungs, in both combined. But, big a number as that is, the number of alveoli is millions. I forget how many millions, 10 million maybe, something like that, in both of the lungs. So there's more branching that occurs after the terminal bronchioles. The individual alveoli, by the way, in terms of size, are very, very small. Probably most of them are about a third of a millimeter in size. And so when you add up all those membranes that make up their opening and divide by the volume of the lungs, that's a lot of surface area for that volume. Now, on the right side of this, in B, at the top, we can see that there are three major kinds of cells in the lung, in the lining of the lung, I should say. One of those, of course, is the endothelial cells that make up the lining of each alveolus. Now, those are the ones that it's labeled right up there. This whitish surface is not the cell. That is a moist surface made up of surfactant. All right? The surfactant gets produced by a different type of cell called great alveolar cells. But the endothelial cells are squamous. First of all, endothelial is epithelial, right? It's just called endo because it's inside a structure. And you should recall from 201 how to classify epithelial, right? You classify them, first of all, based on whether there is one or more layers. What are the words that describe those? Simple or stratified. Well, the epithelium of alveoli in the lungs is simple. But more specifically, once you do that classification, you classify it based on the type of the shape of the cell in that apical layer. Well, here you only have one layer because it's simple. And the shape of these is squamous, right? Which, remember, squamous means thin in the direction from apex to base and wide in the other dimension. So these are the ones that are like floor tiles. Why does this make sense to have simple squamous epithelium in the lung? Right. It's the one that is most ideally suited to diffusion because the flatter you have that cell, the shorter the distance through its thickness. And diffusion works very well, but only over short distances. Well, diffusion is what drives the movement of both the oxygen and the CO2, independently of each other, of course, based on their gradients. Well, most of the surface area that we're seeing in this alveolus is made up of endothelial cells. But of the three types of cells, and I didn't mention the macrophages yet, but they're the third type. Of those three types of cells, the ones that are in fewest number, actually, are the endothelial cells. But that makes sense simply because they're so spread out. It doesn't take as many of them to fill a given amount of surface area because they're so spread out. I don't mean spread out from each other. I mean spread out like rolled out dough. Right, you can make it cover a lot of surface area if it's real flat. They are outnumbered by, or the endothelial cells are outnumbered by these great alveolar cells It's just that you don't see them as often because they have a lot of volume to them. But they produce this surfactant. And surfactant is really important in the lungs. It's a mixture of lipids and other stuff. A surfactant can also be called a wetting agent, because surfactants are used for various reasons in industry. But in the lungs, the surfactant is important because it reduces the force of surface tension that moisture in the lungs would have. Water has high surface tension, right? Which is what causes it to form a droplet, a spherical droplet, as rain, for instance. But it's also what causes the surface of the water to be like a thicker skin that certain insects can walk on, right? Well, that surface tension, because of the hydrogen bonding of water, that water molecules are all attracting each other, that would have the effect of dragging the walls of the alveolus toward the center attractively, which would collapse the individual alveoli. The surfactant reduces that force, so it keeps the alveoli from collapsing. It's also, though, important that the inside of the lung doesn't have very much water in it, also to reduce this surface tension. And so the blood in the capillaries just outside the alveoli actually absorb a lot of the water from the lungs, keeping it from building up in the lungs. And does so for the same reasons we talked about in the lymphatic system, but even more so at the lungs, because the blood pressure in those capillaries is a little bit lower than it is elsewhere in the body. And therefore, the force trying to push the fluid out isn't as high. It's just like we talked about the lymph coming back in at the venous end of a capillary. Well, that's happening at the lungs a lot as well, keeping the lungs from being too wet, which would allow them to collapse. You don't want them to collapse, the alveoli. The macrophages, by the way, you can guess what they do. They're crawling around, phagocytizing debris, mostly debris, but also, when they encounter them, bacteria. Because there are bacteria living in the air, even. You're breathing those in, but it's mostly just solid debris, pieces of dirt that are in the air that make it into the lungs, that because they've gotten past the mucociliary escalator for whatever reason. Or if you're foolish enough to smoke, that's a lot of debris put into your lungs. So the macrophages are actually the most numerous of the cells. The great cells, the great alveolar cells, are medium in number. The endothelial cells, there's fewest of, but they cover the most surface area. So these alveolar macrophages are busy continuously cleaning up your lungs and then dying and then taking a trip on the mucociliary escalator up to your throat where you swallow them. So you swallow millions of these, tens of millions of these a day into your stomach, keeping your lungs clean. The bottom right of this figure shows you what's called the respiratory membrane. And it's called the respiratory membrane because that is the thickness through which the diffusion occurs in order to exchange O2 and CO2 with the blood. And it's important for that to be as thin as possible for the diffusion to work well. So this is why the endothelium of the alveolus is simple squamous, but the same can be said for the endothelium of the capillary, the blood capillary, that's surrounding this, that's just on the outside of this alveolus. Well, any epithelium, remember, has an apex and a base. The apical surface is the unattached surface, right? The basal surface is the surface that the cell is anchored to, and that's actually made up of connective tissue rather than epithelium. But what is that stuff called that any epithelium is built on?
Basement membrane.
So no exception here. To make it as thin as possible, though, the endothelium of the alveolus shares a basement membrane with the endothelium of the red blood cell. I mean, not the red blood cell, the capillary. So there's just as thin as possible a shared basement membrane and endothelial cells on either side of it. The combination of those three, endothelium of the alveolus, basement membrane, and endothelium of the capillary, make up the respiratory membrane. By the way, when it happens very quickly, but oxygen actually has to do quite a bit of movement for this to work well. The oxygen is gas in the alveolar space, of course. That gas, first of all, the oxygen is nonpolar, right? Because two oxygens are exactly equally sharing electrons, so it's a nonpolar molecule, and therefore it has no problem going right through membranes, cellular membranes. This is important, because otherwise you would have to have proteins allowing oxygen through. You don't have to do that because it's a small nonpolar molecule. But anyway, the oxygen has to diffuse from the gas that it's part of, the air that's in the alveolus, through the surfactant, which is liquid, and it's important for that to be as thin as possible because diffusion through a liquid is not nearly as fast. Then it has to diffuse through the phospholipid bilayer of the endothelial cell in the alveolus. Now it's inside the endothelial cell. The detail here isn't shown, but it's inside that cell now, right? The cell that makes up the wall of the alveolus. It's in that cytosol, which is liquid. It has to diffuse through that thickness of liquid in the cell until it reaches the plasma membrane on the other side of the cell. It has to go through that plasma membrane. Now it's out of the lung, and it's in the basement membrane. It has to diffuse through the basement membrane, where it encounters the outer surface of the blood capillary, has to diffuse through the plasma membrane of that blood capillary's endothelial cell. Now it's inside the endothelial cell of the capillary, diffuses through that cytosol, which is liquid, till it reaches the plasma membrane on the inner surface of that endothelial cell. Once it gets through that, now it's in the plasma of the blood running through that capillary, which is still not where it needs to be, right? Now it has to diffuse through that liquid plasma until it hits a third cell type, which is the red blood cell itself. It diffuses through the plasma membrane of the red blood cell. Now it's in the interior of the red blood cell, which is another cytosol compartment, diffuses through that liquid until it finally encounters one of the millions of hemoglobin molecules that are in that one red blood cell. And that's when it binds reversibly to the heme of that hemoglobin, one of the four. And since each hemoglobin has four hemes in it, a single hemoglobin molecule can carry up to four oxygen molecules. There's millions of them in one cell, so one cell can carry millions of O2 molecules, and there are billions of red blood cells in your bloodstream. So you carry a lot of oxygen. But it's not as simple as this red arrow indicates. It has to go through a lot of actual compartments to make it into the blood, or into the hemoglobin of the blood. Okay, 12. Now we can talk about ventilation, which is what I prefer to say, or as the book calls it, respiration. I'm talking about breathing, really, in and out breathing. What kind of breathing is in and out breathing called? Yeah. Not turbulent. Tidal, like the in and out of the tides at a seashore. Anyway, the lungs do not inflate and deflate themselves. The lungs don't have these alveoli that we just talked about don't have muscles. That would just get in the way. That would add thickness, right? So the muscles that are responsible for the movement that's responsible for lung inflation and deflation are extrinsic muscles. Extrinsic meaning outside of the lungs. They are skeletal muscles. And there are a few different types that are involved. Actually, quite a few different muscles are involved, but I'm going to mention mostly three. One is the diaphragm. You have one diaphragm, and that diaphragm is the official boundary between the thorax and the abdomen. But it's a broad, very wide band of muscle. And in its relaxed state, it is dome-shaped, right on the bottom of the lungs. And the superior part of that diaphragm is directly connected to, the parietal pleura at the bottom of the pleura for each lung. When the diaphragm is contracted, it turns from a dome shape to a flatter shape, which means the peak of this dome descends. That's during contraction. So when you're working the diaphragm, what it's doing is moving inferiorly, or it's getting depressed. All right? Well, since the diaphragm is the floor, officially, of the thorax, when you drop that floor, which is what happens when the diaphragm contracts, what you're doing is increasing the volume of the thorax. Because now the floor is lower than it was, right? You're increasing that volume. We'll talk next time more about why the increase in volume is important, but that's what's happening when the diaphragm descends, when it contracts. The diaphragm is the chief muscle of inspiration. Inspiration is the other word for inhalation. So when you're drawing air into the lungs, that's inspiration. And about two-thirds of that inspiration is caused by the fact that the diaphragm descends when you contract it. The other third is mostly due to muscles that are connected to ribs, and they occur between the ribs, and they therefore are called intercostal muscles, because costal means of the ribs. But there are two categories of intercostal muscles. They occur in two layers. The more superficial layer, toward the skin surface, in other words, are called the external intercostals. They could have just as well been called the superficial intercostals, but that's what external here means. They're more superficial. So if you carefully dissect a human or other mammal, once you expose the intercostal muscles, the first ones you'll see will be the external intercostals. Deep to those, meaning on the lung side rather than the skin side, are the internal intercostals. Well, the external intercostals are muscles of inspiration, whereas the internal intercostals are muscles of forced expiration, which is exhalation or outward breathing. So in other words, the two categories of intercostal muscles are antagonistic. They work in opposite directions as far as what they accomplish. All right, well, let me briefly end by saying that when the external intercostals contract, what they really do is pull on the ribs, and they lift the ribs. And because of the shape of the ribs, when the ribs get lifted, that increases the volume of the thorax as well, because the depth of the thorax, what I mean is the the distance from the front of the chest to the back of the chest increases when the lungs get lifted, and so does the width. So the diaphragm already increased the height of the thorax by dropping the floor. The ribs being lifted increases the width, right to left, and the depth, front to back. All of these three things together increase the volume of the thorax, and that's what causes inspiration. I'll continue, though, next time.